Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is Side 2 of For the Record 525, interview with Sander Hicks about the big wedding. This has been recorded on September 4th of the year 2005, and once again, it is my pleasure and privilege to present Sander Hicks, the author of the new book about September 11th, The Big Wedding. Sander, welcome back once again to our airwaves.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Now, we've been talking about Operation Diamondback, Randy Glass, a frightening sting operation which uncovered in concrete terms the plans to bring down the towers, the World Trade Center towers, and September 11th, and apparently these were known to a number of people before the event itself, something that has actually had a fair amount of circulation in various quarters from a variety of sources. One of the people that you talk about in The Big Wedding as not having helped to suppress some of this information, some of the things we spoke about inside, one was a guy named Dave Frasca. Tell us a little more about Dave Frasca and what your problem is with him.
Great. Well, it's a great question, David, because his name keeps on coming up when you talk about all the major FBI whistleblowers. I could talk about Robert Wright, Ken Williams of the Phoenix Memo. Robert Wright was the guy that was tracking Osama bin Laden's financials and felt that he was suppressed from the higher-ups at FBI. Colleen Rowley and I have also spoken about David Frasca and Frasca's boss, Mike Rollins, as being culpable. Colleen Rowley, former Time Magazine Woman of the Year, Whistleblower of the Year, felt that Frasca was guilty of nothing but negligence or oversight. I disagree. I think there was something deliberate. I think Frasca might have been working for somebody else. It might have been some sort of international group. But it's no coincidence that Frasca's name keeps on coming up. And when we talk about Randy Glass and the Florida operation, well, ironically enough, Frasca was not at FBI headquarters at that time. In 1998, when Randy Glass was working for the Joint Terrorism Task Force, guess who was heading that up in Florida, David? David Frasca. And Frasca was extremely hostile to Randy Glass. Every time that Randy Glass came up with something useful, Frasca would suppress him. Frasca started butting heads with his people that were working under him at ATF, agents like Steve Barberini. It's funny, you know, I actually got ATF agent Steve Barberini on the phone, and I did an interview with him for my book, The Big Wedding. And Barberini even said, like, oh, I can't comment on Frasca, whether I like him or not. And then we started talking more and more. I was like, well, you know, it's kind of awful that you're not willing to comment because this guy is obviously doing evil. And, you know, real patriots need to stand up to this kind of thing. And Barberini said, well, I assume this guy's been buried. He's probably back at FBI headquarters, buried somewhere in the bureaucracy. And I was like, are you kidding, man? You don't know? Frasca got promoted after 9/11. He's number three in charge of domestic terrorism nationwide. And Barberini was, like, dumbstruck. His jaw was on the floor. And he was like, you're kidding me. And I was like, no, don't you know what's going on at rival intelligence agencies, rival law enforcement agencies? And Barberini was like, well, that's just it. That's the essence of bureaucracy. The incompetent get promoted.
Well, it not only quote incompetent unquote, but one of the things that's interesting, and just in passing, is Hannah Arendt noted something called the banality of evil. One of the things that happens, and I've been studying these events for over a quarter of a broadcasting about them for over a quarter of a century.
Yeah.
If you want to move up, you basically fit in. The Japanese have an expression, the nail that sticks out gets pounded down.
Right.
And the Turks have an expression I like even better, he who tells the truth gets chased out of nine villages. You know, if you are in an organization, whether it's FBI, CIA, Justice Department, State, or a corporation or any institution, and you discover some serious malfeasance, if you blow the whistle, you're risking your career. And, you know, some people will do that. But, you know, an awful lot of people just keep moving on up, and that, I'm afraid, is how the world is going to end. So,
yeah, here's two quotes from Steve Barberini at ATF. He said, that's why I fight to stay on the bottom. At least we can do good work.
That's a very important quote.
Yeah. And then later he says, the people who can't do the work just get promoted.
Mm-hmm.
And that's exactly the same thing FBI attorney Colleen Rowley said to me. She said that at FBI there is this culture. Nobody wants to go to Washington. Nobody wants to get promoted to uproot their families and travel from the branch offices to Washington. And so, therefore, there is a culture of the apparatchik or a culture of the super bureaucrat, and only the ambitious get promoted, only the people that want to get promoted. So that means that we're encouraging a culture of love of power rather than love of duty. That's a very dangerous time to be in, and so I think Hannah Arendt was totally correct.
Dave Frasca, you mentioned, was keeping an eye on things, or at least theoretically keeping an eye on things in Florida. One of the people that you give a lot of play to in your book, and I was very pleased to see this, was Daniel Hopsiger. Now, Hopsiger is well known to the audience to this program. I've interviewed him a number of times. Did you want to comment briefly about Daniel Hopsiger and what he has been uncovering down there in Jeb Bush land?
Sure. I thought Hopsiker was one of these people whose research I could build on. He's a friend of mine, and when my wife and I went down to Florida to do a little detective work, he let us stay at his place, and so he also showed us around, and it was almost like being inside of one of Hopsiker's books, because he took us to Sharky's, which is the beachside bar where Rudy Deckers, the owner of the Florida Flight School, was picked up by Venice cab driver Bob Simpson with Muhammad Atta about a month before 9/11, when Rudy Deckers claimed to the cameras that he hadn't seen Muhammad Atta 9 months before 9/11. So it's Hopsiker who is like the one guy against a million others who has the truth, while a million others are going along with what the media says. Hopsiker has got some family roots in Venice, Florida. It's been his family's vacation home. So so he knew Venice, Florida really well. And what I did, though, was I went farther than Hopsiker was willing to go. So what I did was I took his research into Muhammad Atta that said the official story is completely wrong. Muhammad Atta was not a Muslim fundamentalist who did things out of love for the Palestinian cause. It's more like Muhammad Atta was a cocaine-using party boy who would hang around with Amanda Keller, his American girlfriend, and hang out with Germans and Austrians, who he referred to as brother. Very odd behavior when you compare that to the official story of Muhammad Atta. So what I started speculating, and I was backed up on this by a contact I have at the SEC, who works as a part-time consultant to the Securities and Exchange Commission, and she was feeding me some information that was very helpful. And we both came to the conclusion that Muhammad Atta was some sort of double agent. He was working, obviously, for Al-Qaeda, or what is referred to as Al-Qaeda, which is really Muslim Brotherhood, and we'll talk about that in a minute. But Muhammad Atta was clearly had juice on this side as well. I don't know if that was CIA, NSA, U.S. Customs, but I've got other sources, not just Hopsiker. I'm also friendly with a FBI whistleblower who has been unjustly imprisoned. He's been up in upstate New York at Clinton Correctional ever since 1990, I believe it is. His name is Richard Taus, and Taus is in jail, incarcerated with a former Pakistani ISI/CIA operative named Mian Farouk. Now, Farouk knew Muhammad Atta. And if Farouk's story is true, and if it's true that Farouk is former CIA, then that means the CIA knew all about Muhammad Atta. So all these recent revelations, Mr. Emery, about the Able Danger, you know, Pentagon reporting, oh, we knew about Muhammad Atta as early as 99 or 2000. Well, all that stuff is just the tip of the iceberg. Really, the Pentagon and the CIA probably knew about Muhammad Atta probably as early as 1996, when he first started assembling the Al-Quds Mosque in Hamburg. Also in 96, this is really interesting, Mian Farouk, the guy that's incarcerated with Richard Taus, upstate New York, Mian Farouk tells me through Taus that not only did he know Muhammad Atta, but when Farouk was working as a customs agent for the CIA at JFK International Airport, for some reason the CIA, you see, had sent him in to infiltrate U.S. Customs at JFK Airport. Muhammad Atta shows up in a uniform of a pilot, and Farouk says, "Oh, Muhammad Atta, what are you doing here?" And Muhammad Atta claimed that he now had an ownership interest in a certain Florida flight school. And then this is in the year 1996. So if the CIA knew this about him and was keeping him, you know, keeping in touch with him as far back as 96, then, like I said, Able Danger, the recent revelations about Able Danger is just the tip of the iceberg.
One of the things that we've noted in our conversations with Daniel Hopsiker in the past is that some of these Iran-Contra-related or connected drug smuggling networks appear to have been the vehicle through which some of the operational personnel that Daniel has researched down there, Mohammed Atta and the others, infiltrated into the United States. Well, a point that I made in the past, I'll just touch on it in passing, Sandra, is that one of the things that I think may have been something of a precedent, an operational precedent for what we see in September 11th, was the bombing of Pan Am 103, in which Islamic terrorists or Middle Eastern terrorists, who also were working with some of the Iran-Contra drug networks, specifically a fellow named Manzar El-Kassar, got a bomb onto that plane through what had been a controlled drug delivery network. So I suspect that may have been something of a precedent or a paradigm. By the way, you know who was in charge with, quote, investigating, unquote, Pan Am 103?
Jamie Gorelick?
No, Robert Mueller.
Robert Mueller. Oh, yes, exactly. That was Lockerbie, right? 103?
Yes, it was. Right, so right. He has some interesting. He was, of course, also investigating BCCI or, quote,
right.
Investigating BCCI. You know who the number two U.S. attorney on the BCCI investigation was? Rudolph Giuliani.
So, oh, that's right. Yeah, the U.S. Attorney.
Very, very interesting cast of characters. Now, speaking of interesting casts of characters, one of the people that you talk about, and this is something, too, that has not had a lot of discussion, in Operation Diamondback, the Randy Glass sting operation that we talked about through much of Side 1, one of the people whom Randy had taped was a guy named Mohammed El-Amir.
Right.
Tell us about Mohammed El-Amir, his brother, and who has represented his brother.
Yeah, great. Well, actually, this is something I wanted to talk about when you talked about the banality of evil, and I think it goes farther. When I take a lot of research that you yourself have done, Mr. Emery, into Muslim Brotherhood and the international far right and how they work together at certain times and they work with Islamic extremists for their own ends, and I would say it's the ends of the international ruling class, which is inherently unethical. So I go from there to a more specific instance in which we look at the history of, like you said, Mohammed El-Amir, his brother Mahdi El-Amir, who were both implicated in being financiers of 9/11, financiers of Osama bin Laden. Now, they were brought to court at one point, and their attorney happened to be Michael Chertoff. At the time, he was in between gigs as I think he was finishing up his time as a U.S. attorney and about to become appointed to head up Operation Green Quest. And so he only had like a very brief period as a private attorney, but he just happened to be the defender of these Egyptians who were financiers of Osama bin Laden. And it's an incredible anomaly, and it should have completely spoilt his chances to become the director of Homeland Security. However, there seemed to be an extremely tight media blackout. Now, so what I do in my book is I dive in and I build on your own research that you've done into Muslim Brotherhood, and I go back to 1976 and I look at Team B, I look at Cheney and Rumsfeld in the Ford White House and how they fabricated intelligence even then and they manipulated reality. And I look at the Project for the New American Century, which is a neocon think tank, which says that it's okay to manipulate reality with a, quote, cataclysmic event on the scale of, quote, Pearl Harbor, and it seems to be the 1992 call for 9/11 to happen to advance the interests of big business and the far right. So I go from that to saying, let's look specifically at the case of Michael Chertoff, because it would seem, and now this is going back to your banality of evil analogy, it would seem that not only is evil banal and the not standing up to it is the way you get ahead, but it seems that we've gone to the from the banality of evil to the virtue of evil in this administration. It would seem that if you really want to get ahead in this administration, what you do is you participate in White House cover-ups and you also go out of your way to defend people who have affiliations to Islamic terror, Saudi Arabian money, Pakistani muscle. And that would be Dr. Mahdi El-Amir. Now, to give you a little background, Dr. Mahdi El-Amir is a doctor practicing in New Jersey. The state of New Jersey took over his HMO at one point, pretty recently, in the past couple of years, and they were looking for the $15 million that was missing. They found $10 million. $5 million was still missing, still unaccounted for. It looks like that ended up in the hands of Osama bin Laden. So Dr. Mahdi El-Amir had a lot to answer for, but he hired one of the most powerful attorneys at the time, Michael Chertoff. who just happened to be in the middle of a brief period of working as a private attorney. And Chertoff got him off, and Magdi Alamir never went to jail. And Randy Glass first tipped me off to this because Randy Glass was interfacing with Magdi Alamir's brother, Mohammed Alamir, who was trying to arrange for a major international arms shipment. Now, the reason this is really crucial to my book is because all throughout my book, I am critical of the more establishment, polite, corporate voices in the media. And I name names. I'm not afraid, and I think it's the duty of every patriotic American to call it as you see it. And if people have chickened out or have sat down when America really needed some heroes and some volunteers, then I think it's time to say who those people are that were too cowardly to stand up. And specifically, I talk about a very contentious phone conversation I have. It's pretty funny, but at the time it was harrowing, with a reporter for the Washington Post named Douglas Mintz. Now, according to Randy Glass...
Douglas or John Mintz?
Oh, that's right. John, thank you for catching that. He co-wrote it with a guy named Douglas. It was John Mintz.
By the way, the Douglas he wrote, Douglas Farrow, who actually has a very good book about al-Qaeda fighting. It's called Blood from Stones. It's quite good and has some excellent information in there about Bank al-Taqwa. But John Mintz does write for the Washington Post, which, along with the great lady of the New York Times, is arguably the most important newspaper of record, so to speak.
You're right. I'm looking at my notes right now and looking at the book. And this is what Randy Glass said. Let's see. I write here. Around the time of Chertoff's confirmation hearings, Glass contacted Mintz. Glass remembers, quote, John loved it. Chertoff, that whole piece. All of a sudden, John called me up and said, Randy, you know, listen, they're not letting me run with it. Something funny's going on. I talked to other people in the biz. There's a lot of strings being pulled in town. Everything you told me is true. We verified everything. Close quote. So now, me being the intrepid investigative journalist, I called up Mr. John Mintz at the Washington Post, got him on the phone right away, and I said, this is what Randy Glass said, is it true? And John Mintz did something very curious. He said, you can't quote me verbatim. And I said, oh, okay. And then he said, it's all a lie. Everything Randy Glass is telling you is a complete lie. And I was like, okay. And he was like, this is obviously some sort of conspiracy theory. And I said, well, now, hold on a second, Mr. Mintz. This is not a conspiracy theory. When the state of New Jersey takes over Dr. Magdi Alamir's HMO, my friend, and finds a blatant 5 million missing, it's hardly in the realm of theory. And, you know, Chertoff defends this guy. And so the conversation did not go well with Mr. Mintz, and he was extremely hostile because of the question. And it was never really clear why he was so hostile to me just for asking a simple question. But Mintz was not alone. I also talked to John Pacenti at the Palm Beach Post down in Miami Beach, Palm Beach, West Palm Beach, and he said he had the same reaction. He tried to do a story on Chertoff's connections to financiers of Osama bin Laden, and his editors would not let him do the story.
All right. It certainly is. The media, I think the same sort of thing applies as we were speaking about in connection with bureaucracies and institutional involvement. If you want to move up, you basically go with the flow, so to speak.
Right.
The nail that sticks out gets pounded down, or he who tells the truth gets chased out of nine villages. It reminds me, Sander, too, this is something of a parenthetical element. The same thing is often true with the so-called alternative media. In late 1999, when there was this firestorm of criticism from the so-called progressive sector about Bill Clinton, I was pointing out the relationship between George W. Bush, from late 1999 on, the relationship between George W. Bush and the bin Laden family and James R. Bath, and pointing out specifically the information about that connection from the book Fortunate Son by J.H. Hatfield, which you then republished. I was accessing it from the hardcover edition, but
right.
you then republished Fortunate Son in softcover under the auspices of Soft Skull Publishing. But nobody that I know of other than yourself would touch the Bush bin Laden connection prior to September 11th. It's certainly not in 1999. So the phenomenon that you were noting with John Mintz is not, unfortunately, limited to just the mainstream press.
Right, right. I think, though, when it comes to the mainstream press, my attitude is instead of one of condemnation or judgment or copying an imperious, holier-than-thou attitude, I think it's just important to recognize that when you've got a clear case of people ducking a major story, you have to ask yourself why.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's evident that there's a lot of fear, and it's evident that there's a lot of material power, that if they did do the story, there would be a material effect that they would feel the force of what they're dealing with right away. And so I guess there's a contradiction in my own life, because I'm trying to figure out, like, why I feel that I can do this when they can't. And I guess I haven't been beaten down enough.
Well, you know, it's important that people do what they can. Sadly, and I'm not going to editorialize past the point, but I'm afraid I've seen the end of this movie, and it's a very, very tragic movie. And barring a serious editorial intervention, the bad guys win. So I think it's important that you and myself and others who are in a position to do something, do everything possible under the circumstances. Back to the big wedding, Sander.
Yeah.
Michael Chertoff. Now, of course, you talked about the fact that he represented Dr. Magdi El Amir, who was using his New Jersey-based HMO and related businesses to fund al-Qaeda. Well, Michael Chertoff has moved up in the world. Tell us a little bit about Chertoff.
Sure. Well, Michael Chertoff was nominated for the Director of Homeland Security. He's the guy that is now on the TV every day trying to explain why the federal government is incompetent in the face of a hurricane. And Chertoff is the one that looks like a skeleton, and his politics are skeletal and deathly.
And he was the fellow in between his appointment as Director of Homeland Security and the time when he was representing Dr. Magdi El Amir.
Exactly. He headed up Operation Green Quest.
Indeed. Indeed.
So he was supposed to be the guy tracking down the financial network of international terror, which was really ironic because the appointment as Green Quest head overlapped by about a month with his private practice of defending a key proponent of $5 million of Islamic terror financing. So go ahead and riddle me that. You know, tell me how that works, that the ruling class in this country has appointed one of their own to theoretically prosecute the kind of people that he is simultaneously defending. I want to talk about Rita Katz really quickly. I know it's somebody that you respect, and she's the author of a book called Terrorist Hunter, I believe it is.
And by the way, someone who has been, to a large extent, eclipsed by the September 11th research community. It's not a name you hear about very much, which is unfortunate. Go ahead, Sandra.
Yeah, you're right. She's one of these people that's, I guess, just too real for some of us some of us out there.
She has bigger expletive deleteds than most of the men I know. Go ahead.
Anyway, Rita Katz is I guess she's a little bit more straight than some of us, and she has actually worked for Green Quest and at the same time calls it as she sees it. And she said that when I was working for Green Quest as an investigator, we were tracked by CIA and by other international intelligence groups. And she was disturbed highly and started feeling that their level of surveillance was deliberate intimidation, perhaps, because she saw them not trying to conceal it, as you pointed out to me earlier. And so it seems to me that, she says herself, she says she knows it was surveillance because she was with agents who knew how to identify surveillance as such. And she felt, she remarked to herself numerous times at the time, why is it that simply tracking international terrorists is perturbing the CIA?
Well, one of the things, of course, with the Operation Green Quest raid of March 20th, 2002, it uncovered a milieu that it won. If you follow it in one direction, it goes to the Islamic Institute, people like Grover Norquist, Karl Rove, associates of George Bush, mainstream, arch Republicans. Then it goes in other directions, and it goes in the direction of al-Qaeda and the Bank al-Taqwa, a name very well known to this. Tell us about Bank al-Taqwa, Sander.
Sure. Well, first, before we get into al-Taqwa, I want to say that I'm not even really comfortable with the word al-Qaeda anymore. I think it's not as real a word as, let's say, al-Taqwa or Muslim Brotherhood. And the reason for that is, if you really look at the history of the word, it didn't really even exist as a word until 1996, and it wasn't used widely until after the embassy bombings of 1998. So, we're kind of dealing with an abstract concept. A lot of scholars have been pointing out in works that I've seen recently that it's more like referring to the mafia. Well, the mafia isn't really one group. It's mm-hmm. a loose federation of like-minded people and, you know, chaotic criminal culture.
A number of authors, by the way, we're down to our last couple of minutes here, so I have to move. A number of I shouldn't say authors, but terrorist experts have noted that Al-Qaeda, which was at one point a concrete organization, has morphed into Al-Qaedaism around the world, that there are a lot of groups which feel X amount of ideological affinity for one reason or another, but that it has undergone some transitions. Tell us about Bank. I'll talk with Sandra. We're almost at the end of this side.
Sure. Okay, well, what I really wanted to talk about was Al-Taqwa and the bigger picture, the bigger fish to fry of Muslim Brotherhood. And mm-hmm. you're cited in my book. I cite other people's research into Muslim Brotherhood. But that's what we're really talking about here. And it deserves more research from more people, maybe another book down the line. But we're talking, when we talk about Muslim Brotherhood, we're talking about the organization that Ramzi Youssef, Muhammad Atta Jr. and Sr. were a part of, the organization that was behind Osama bin Laden and his group MAK, which was his funding vehicle for the CIA to funnel weapons and intelligence into the Mujahideen civil war. And this is the group that goes back to its founding in 1928, and ever since it went from originally being an anti-colonialist group in Egypt to being a group that very pragmatically worked with Hitler and the SS. They had like 25,000 people working for Hitler in the SS during World War II. And it traditionally has seemed to be the group that is the connection between the far right and Islamic terror, which can be very useful when the United States ruling class wants it to be.
Yeah, Bank Al-Taqwa is a very, very interesting institution indeed, and something its many tributaries running in many directions, familiar to members of the audience. Sandra, we're near the end of this side. Give us some information about where people can get The Big Wedding and any other contact information, websites, et cetera, that you would like to put
Great,
out there.
Great, cool, yeah. The full title is The Big Wedding, 9/11, The Whistleblowers, and The Cover-Up. And the book is available at my website, voxpopnet.net. That's our coffeehouse bookstore publishing company with offices here in Brooklyn. People should check out voxpopnet.net for information about other titles we publish, including former CIA paramilitary specialist Captain Brad Ayers, who's got an incredible book coming out in the fall, and other titles. And if you're in Brooklyn, come by and see us. We're at 1022 Cortelyou Road in Brooklyn, New York, and that address is also on voxpopnet.net. We're distributed to the book trade in North America by SCB Book Distributors, and so that means you can get us really from any bookstore or online site of your choice.
And when I put up the written description for this program on the Spitfire website, there will be links to Sandra's websites. Parenthetically, can people get the paperback edition of Fortunate Son from there?
Well, you know, that was my old company, Soft Skull.
Right.
And you can get it from softskull.com.
So same management but different company.
Different management, different company.
Oh, okay. I will also point out to listeners that all of the For the Record programs are being archived by sister station WFMU-FM in Jersey City, New Jersey, right across the river from where the World Trade Center used to be. And WFMU is also podcasting the programs. For the Record is distributed by Spitfire. Their website, www.spitfirelist.com, has a wealth of printed and audio information and links to a number of different websites featuring books, featuring search functions, featuring all kinds of things, including a page to click on to support the work that I'm doing as well. www.spitfirelist.com, another invaluable research source. We have been speaking with Sandra Hicks, the author of the new book about September 11th, The Big Wedding, subtitled 9/11, The Whistleblowers, and The Cover-Up. Out, is it soft cover?
Yep, it is in soft cover.
In soft cover, courtesy of Vox Pop. For Sandra Hicks, this is Dave Emery saying thanks for listening to Side 2 of For the Record, program number 525, being recorded on September 4th of 2005.